All right, hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9. And I'm coming at you live here from the center of the universe. And that, of course, is Clear Creek, Colorado, Clear Creek County, Colorado. So just a fantastically beautiful day here. And this is the Rabbit Hole and doing a special edition, segment here. And Writer's Talk. So in the studio with me is Marla Bell. So Marla, you want to test that microphone for me, please?
Good morning.
All right. It's actually afternoon, but that's okay.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
See?
Well, I started out coming here in the morning, so.
Yeah, there you go. All right. And, we're looking forward to, spending the next 45 minutes to an hour talking to Marla. But Marla is an award-winning author. And she's won gold from the Mom's Choice Awards of the Teen YA, that's Young Adults Fantasy Trilogy, Chronicles of the Secret Prince, and the Science Fantasy Next Time I See You. That's your latest work, isn't it?
It is my brand new, and it just came out in June.
Fantastic. Oh, looking forward to talking about it then. She says, having escaped the mosquito-infested land of Iowa, where she grew up, and the scorpion-infested land of Arizona, where she was transplanted for way too long, she now lives happily ever after in Colorado, spreading magic wherever she can as a full-time writer, full-time babysitter, and full-time cheerleader, full-time cook, housekeeper, and full-time taxicab driver, and hopefully full-time writer. I think I said that right, but you got so many hats you're wearing here.
Yes, and I don't get to write nearly as much as I want to.
Oh,
that hopefully will change soon.
Yeah. Well, what got you into writing in the first place, Marla?
It was kind of a bunch of different things. I wrote when I was in high school, and that kind of put a little trigger in my head that maybe I had something. I was called out in my class, which embarrassed me to death. When my teacher did that, but he did read my work, and that planted that seed inside me that, wow, maybe I'm not as worthless as I thought I was. And I kept that seed, but then life gets in the way. I had kids. I had four children, and raising four children takes all the time in the world. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even a reader when I was young. I didn't start reading until my kids, it was an escape to get away from my kids for a while, and I started reading, and then I could not get enough. And that whole time, I kept thinking, wow, I could write, I could write, because I did write in high school, and my teacher said I was good, so maybe I can write. And so I tried it, and my kids I have three boys, and so, and this was before the age of Harry Potter.
Okay.
And when my boys got to be about fifth grade, middle grade, they had nothing to read. Because there was really not a whole lot out there for boys.
Mm-hmm.
Most books that were printed were girl books. And my boys started gravitating to other things. Or they wanted to read Stephen King horror, which is like, no, not yet.
Yeah.
So I started writing little stories for them. I never really finished one because something would always come up. But I had a whole bunch of those stories for them. And then when Harry Potter came along, J.K. Rowling wrote that book, and to me, that's my favorite. That's my favorite of all times, because I love fantasy, first of all. But I loved that she brought so many kids back to reading, because I think that was a lost thing there for a while. And so many kids came back to reading and discovered the joy of reading again. And the whole time I was reading that series, I just kept thinking, oh my gosh, what are the kids going to read after the series is done?
Mm-hmm.
And so, that just was in my head. And so I thought, I'm going to finish one of my stories. So I picked it back up and wrote the original book was traditionally published, and it was called The Secret Prince of Tirnanog. And I've since gone indie published and republished it under the name of Before the Full Moon Rises.
I think that's fantastic. When I'm listening to you, Marla, it seems to me a couple synchronistic events happens. One is back when you were 16, 17 years old, and I taught juniors. So I can picture the classroom. I can picture you in there, and you're going like, oh, God, I hate being in here. And so much of that reason kids get turned off to school is that the school's not meeting their needs in terms of their educational, how they learn. And you get this opportunity, the teacher gives you an opportunity to do an extra credit assignment, and then you go, okay, whatever, and then to be rewarded, because I think you were the only one whose paper was read, I think.
It was, mm-hmm. And I was a horrible student. I did not like school. All I could think of was getting out of it, mm-hmm. And as quickly as possible. And I did just only enough to get by. Well, my English grade was quite low, and I knew that wasn't enough to get by, so I had to get that extra credit. So I wrote the ending, an alternative ending to Silas Marner, which was our book that we had to be read that semester, and I turned it in. Never thought another thing about it. I was just hoping that I could get my grade up just a little bit.
Yeah.
And he did. He pulled it out, and he didn't tell me he was going to do that in the beginning. He just pulled it out and he said, "I have this great story that I want to read to you." And he started reading, and I was like, "Oh my God, that's my book." Or that's my story, and I was so embarrassed, mm-hmm. and I was hoping he wouldn't say who wrote it, but he did, you know, and that just planted that seed.
How did the kids react, your fellow students?
You know, they all gave me kind of the look, you know, and stuff, but not, you know, nothing much, but I really seriously just kind of shriveled in my seat. I just got as low as I could possibly get.
Yeah.
And stayed that way through the class. You know, a couple of them, as we left, said, you know, that was really good, you know, but we were high school kids. They didn't.
Yeah, and that's a time of maturity also, and then that starts to take off, and then that also leads into making other connections with other students you might not have been friends with in the first place, then share that experience and love of writing and reading.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. But then the other one is, like you say, your boys were getting their older kids now, you know, what, 11, 12, whatever.
Yep. Right. Uh-huh.
At that time. And, you know, getting turned off. And that's what something I learned, my experience, whether it's universally true or not, is that when I was in the classroom, I can get the girls to read pretty much mm-hmm. anything. But the boys, it was like pulling teeth to get them into. Boy, if it wasn't a boy's story, forget it, you know. Once you had them hooked, then, like I would have with my freshmen, I could get the boys to read Romeo and Juliet, and they'd be the girls, and the girls would be the boys. And we had a lot of fun with it, too, but they can get into some really deep literature. But you have to get them hooked. And that then sets you off, you know, to writing, then young adult. They're, you know, primarily targeted for your kids.
For my kids, yeah.
And there you go after that.
Yeah. That's what, you know, and that's still my love. I still love to write young adult books,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but I enjoy reading them, too.
Now, is a young adult in fantasy, sci-fi fantasy, is that kind of synchronous, you know, what do I want to say, you know, that it kind of goes with the territory there, there's a meshing there, that young adults prefer this particular genre, do you think, or what?
You mean the fantasy genre, or just young adult genre?
Yeah, well, young adults, fantasy.
Fantasy
itself.
You know, I do. I think fantasy is huge right now, and it has been for quite a while. And, you know, there's just so much going on in the world and in the kids' lives nowadays. They've got so much to worry about. I think they want to get lost in a fantasy. You know, it's always a world where the hero's going to win. And I think they want to see that there's maybe hope or maybe if they do something that they can win too. So I think mm-hmm. it's just a way for them to kind of get away from what's going on out there.
Do you write on topics, themes, bring in concepts that are relevant to, you know, like with the young adults? Okay, they're going from childhood into adulthood. And so developing into young men and young women, the whole dating scene comes up, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, the social pressure, the peer pressure that's out there. Do you kind of wrap those in at all with your topics?
Well, my trilogy, my first fantasy trilogy is a story about a boy who kind of becomes of age and finds out, discovers who he is, you know, and what his role in life is. So in that tale... I don't have a whole lot of romance in my novels. He does have a girl who is his, you know, kind of cohort throughout the series that helps him along the way, kind of Hermione type thing. And he does have an interest in her. He does develop a romantic interest in her, but it's not a focal point. You know, it's very high fantasy, okay. And it's more coming of age and kind of discovering who he is and accepting what he can and can't do.
Okay. So, well, that's essential. That's critical because we start to identify who we are, just like you did when you were 16. And you know, I assume you had no. Prior thinking that I'm going to be this writer, yet there's something there. So what happens then, with younger, because they have to figure out life for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. They do. And again, life is hard. So, I mean, even in our day, you know, which is long before, you know, all of the school shootings and everything, there was, you know, you had to figure out, you know, you always had that challenge of, where am I going to fit into this, into this crazy world?
Mm-hmm.
And how am I going to survive?
Yeah, and you know, and you wrote the, was now a trilogy, right?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about that, and then we'll get into before the, or the next time. The next time I see you. Okay, let's talk about that, because that's more sci-fi.
Sci-fi is the next time I see you. Yeah, it's
Time travel.
Yeah.
Okay,
and the other one, the trilogy is high fantasy, definitely.
Okay.
It goes into the world of Chernanook.
Okay, and what is that?
It's the land of the fae, the fairies, the higher realm where, you know, I kind of describe it as, if you think of, it's just another dimension. So it's connected to this, to the lower realm, which is what we live in. But so you kind of think of heaven without the dead people walking around.
Okay.
So it's where the fae, the live, the fae reign. There are fairies that look very much like humans. All the fairy tale monsters, the orcs, the ogres, you know, all of the fairy tale type monsters.
Okay. So, and do you create all your own characters? Do you borrow, like you mentioned, I thought you said orcs, so that would be like J.R.R. Tolkien.
Well, I did borrow the orcs. Well, I mean, you know, there's kind of standard monsters out there. I didn't develop too many new ones because I like the... You know, I didn't feel the need to. There's plenty of ones you can grab from. A couple of them are there's Corrigans, which, I mean, a lot of them are from myth. You know, a lot of the Celtic myth and stuff. They have great monsters.
Yeah.
So the Corrigans and the Spriggans, they're different types of little monster fairy type things that that I pulled from ancient myths.
Oh, that's interesting, because what makes me just provoke the thought in my head, which I love, is that, you know, when I look back in, say, Greek mythology, you know, the Gorgons, whatever, okay? And so we have these hideous monsters, Medusa, and, you know, so if you included Medusa in your story, nobody would bat an eyelash.
Exactly.
Right? But then when we tap into, like, Tolkien with the orcs and the ents and the other creatures that are in there, why can't they be as timeless as, like you mentioned, in Celtic literature and also the Greek literature? So the creatures that we create in the 21st century be as timeless as the ancients.
And I think they're going to be. I mean, I think you're going to see orcs. I just watched a movie last night. It's been out on Netflix for a while, called Bright, with Will Smith. It's
okay.
A Netflix-only type movie made for Netflix. And it was about orcs. I mean, it had the orcs in it. So it's like, yeah, I do think that especially orcs are going to be carry on going forward. Because almost everybody in the world knows what an orc is now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think, you know, and the reason might be, without getting too far off into psychology and so forth, but how these different creatures represent aspects of our unconscious or the archetypes within.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you have an orc, it's like this very vile type of thing, compared to a fairy who might be far more, uplifting, I suppose. I don't know.
Well, again, there's different types of fairies. There's a slew of fairies, and there's bad fairies as well as good fairies, you know, and there's different kinds of them too. So,
oh,
and there's both in this book. So, then solitary fairies are the bad, and there's the main villain in the trilogy is an unsolitary fairy.
That's what makes reading, you know, even let's say I'm an adult, and do I want to read young adults, for example, is that it's not only the escape, but then how you develop those particular characters in themselves. And that could be very thought-provoking.
Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of King Arthur. I've always been loved, and I've read just about, I think, most books about that have anything to do with King Arthur, or Excalibur, or Avalon, or whatever. I just love everything. And it always, the one thing that always bothered me, and I kept searching and looking for more books on it, was the fact that after Merlin, the magician, helps King Arthur, he rides away, mm-hmm. and you never hear another thing mentioned about him. He never comes back. And I always wondered, like, okay, what happened to him?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that always has been in my mind. So I put that in my book. I brought him into my book. So there's a lot of King Arthur references throughout this whole book. Merlin comes in, Mordred comes in, Avalon comes in. The sword that he receives is Excalibur's twin brother sword, forged on the same day or the same time, struck by the same lightning, you know. So it's got the special powers. So you now know what happens to Merlin.
So, yeah, because I always pick, because Merlin, he youthes, he doesn't age, right? He comes backwards in time.
Well, he can, yep, he can. Yeah, well, you have to.
So, what is his ending? He's not going to ride off to the sunset like King Arthur, you know, on
right.
like on Avalon,
exactly.
whatever, you know, or Odysseus and, you know, Valhalla for the.
Right.
But so, what happens with Mar? So, that's an intriguing question there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I brought him back and I gave him an answer, so.
Very good.
Yep.
All right. Well, you're just going to have to read it. So, you, your new work, though, is. You know, more into sci-fi.
Yep, it's a little bit older, for a little bit older age. The trilogy, basically, fifth grade up can read that, I would say, you know. The time travel is a little bit, it doesn't have sex, drugs, or huge violence or anything in it, but it's still more adult content, in my mind. So people who... Because I was at Denver Comic Con this year and was selling my books and talking to the readers. And, you know, so a young kid would come up and want to read it. And it's like, yeah, you know, I'd wait. I'd wait a little bit, a couple more years before you pick it up. Because it does have the main story of it is a girl who loses her boyfriend to... he's a victim of one of the mass shootings.
Okay.
Not in a school, mm-hmm. you know, in an outside venue, but still, that's, you know, to me, it's still that,
yeah.
that depression, that anxiety, all of that feeling that she goes through because of that, escalates her into this whole matter of mm-hmm. trying to get over it.
And certainly high school kids could deal with that.
Absolutely. High school kids, no problem, you know. I would, you know, maybe even 13 years and up,
mm-hmm.
but it's just, you know, a little bit more adult contact because she is very depressed.
Yeah. Okay. And so her boyfriend, now you were telling me that you know, because you time travel. Interesting, not you personally, but maybe you have. I don't know. So, what was it like? But you know, in your studies, you had to study this, you know, to give authenticity, as every writer needs to do.
I know.
You know, to your writing. So, talk about your experience.
Well, you know, I'm one of those writers who do, even though I write fantasy, and you can make up anything you want. You get, you know, I could have made up any way to get her back in time, but. For some reason, I have to have reality in my fantasy, if that even makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I have had this. I've wanted this story in my. I've had this story in my head for probably a decade or more, and I've just always wanted to write a time travel. But I didn't want. And there's two ways of time travel. I mean, you can do the magic where they just go through a stone, you know, or something like that. But I didn't. To me, that wasn't serving my purpose of what she was going to be doing. So she needed to have a time machine. And I couldn't find a way to get a normal person like you or I. You know, we don't have the opportunity to jump into a spaceship and go to fly faster than the speed of light or fly to a black hole, which is, you know, pretty much the only ways, if you look on the internet, that you can get time travel.
Right.
So you've got to do all this stuff. And so this is a college. My main character's name is Kat. Kat's a normal college student but at CU Denver or CU Boulder. And she doesn't have any way of getting to a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kept researching and researching. And then one day I found an article about a professor back east, at a college back east, who was actually spent his entire career, his entire life, trying to come up with on a hypothesis for time travel,
mm-hmm.
of how to do it. And he says that he has found a way to time travel. And he is in the process of building a time machine. And this is a real thing. And, you know, I've read it, and I was so excited, because it's like, yes, this is, you know, and it's his machine. He's built just a small scale model, tabletop scale model, which obviously is not going to be able to send a person back in time. So I did have to, you know, fantasize a little bit on that and make up, you know, expand on it. But
right.
I've taken his basic hypothesis and just built on that,
mm-hmm.
too. So it's a real hypothesis that he thinks will work someday,
mm-hmm.
and just expanded on it to make it fit my purpose. So it's really pretty cool. So, and it's probably about as realistic as you're ever going to find right now.
Okay.
Out there. So.
Yeah, and as long as it's plausible, because you're working in two worlds. First of all, Kat's in the real world as we know it.
Yep.
Okay, but then she goes into this other realm. Okay, now that seems to me, because I'm not a fantasy writer, so correct me on this, that if the story's completely set in this magical land, wherever, then all the rules have changed. It's okay. You can play with a whole lot of things, including gravity works the opposite way, I guess. I don't know. But when you're going from our current world into another...
Not with the time machine. The time machine basically is... And what's different about this time travel is that most time travels, the author takes the character back like 100 years, 200
mm-hmm.
years, whatever. Massive amount of years, you know. So they're way back in a time that they're not familiar with. And, you know, and that just adds a whole bunch more complication to it. And I've never, so many of them make it. I've just always wondered, you know, they put a person back 200 years and that person fits in perfectly. And it's like, I don't think that would happen. But anyway, so Kat, you know, the one thing this professor determined, and it makes sense to me, is that you cannot go back with a time machine. You cannot go back in time before the time machine was built, because there was no time machine there to go to.
To receive that person.
Yeah,
that
so,
entity.
You know,
okay.
And that, to me, that makes sense. In my head, which is totally 100% right brain, so this stuff, I can't tell you. I spent hours in cloud just thinking, oh my God, my head's going to explode when I was researching this, but... that makes sense to me, is that you can't go back. And so she only goes back 16 months in time. And that's as far as she can go back, because the machine was built 16 months before she discovers it.
Hmm.
Which was just 2 months before the shooting. So it fit in her needs, because she wanted to go back to stop the shooter. So she is not going back to a magical realm. She's not going back to another realm. She is literally going back in time to the same space, just 16 months before, that's already in the past.
Okay, so not leaving this world, going into another.
Exactly.
Just going back there.
Going back, just going strictly back in time.
Mm-hmm. Now, which would be fascinating, it's fascinating also because, let's say, hypothetically, she can do that, which I assume she does.
She does.
That's the whole point of the story, is that, okay, so she does this, and so then interferes with the flow of history at that point. Then does that have other consequences down the road for now?
Well, You would think that it would have to, right? If you go back in time.
In my left brain, I'm thinking that, but I could be wrong, so go ahead.
If you go back in time, I would have to think that anything you do back there is going to make some kind of, it's going to put a ripple in the universe, you know, and that ripple, you know, wasn't there before, so it would have to do, but again, you know, everybody has their own beliefs in time, about that, you know. Stephen King wrote a time travel where he sent a man back to stop Kennedy from being shot.
Okay.
His book was 11/22/63. And it was interesting, too, to see, you know, a guy going back to stop that. But, you know, some people believe that you can't change the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't want to give away my story, so no. I'm not going to...
Yeah, right. Spoiler alert.
She definitely comes across... it's not as easy as she thought. She thought she'd be able to go back in time, stop the shooter, and everything would go back to normal. Would go back to the way that it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
The way that it was before. And she finds that the universe has a different plan for her and for everything, so...
That's the fun part there too, because of all the complications. I'm thinking, and I am no quantum physicist in by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm fascinated by the study of it and the principles of it. And one of my favorite videos, I watch it periodically, is "What the Bleep Do We Know?" And from about 15 years ago, and there's a professor on there, and he says that, you know, from physics point of view, there's no reason why we can't remember the future. Well, remember is past, but he says that we would know the future. What there's no that in a certain way, and that just baffles me. And you know, so it's different than what you're doing there. But you know, so with your professor who's doing some serious work here, is that what is the potential out there in the quantum world? We don't know.
Oh, we don't know. And it's, they are taking leaps and bounds. I mean, Einstein didn't believe in time travel, you know, and Hawking started out not believing in time travel, but he's, you know, towards the end of his life, he even said, you know, it is possible, you know, and but we're not in advance, we're not advanced enough to be able to do that yet. It's going to take a much more advanced civilization, but that doesn't mean that it isn't possible. And what the time machine does is that it's a rotating laser lights that they've, you know, and again, I've done so much research on this that, and I'm hoping that if there's a physicist out there listening to me and I'm saying something wrong, you know, I'm really not a physicist. what I gathered from my research is that, you know, the sun produces so much light and that it warps time just through that energy, because light is energy, you know, and energy creates gravity, and gravity warps time. And so these lights, rotating lights, produce this massive amount of gravity, which then twists the, if you think about it, and the one thing that the professor shows in one of his videos is that he's got a cup of coffee and he's got his spoon swirling. So just picture a cup of coffee stirring, you know, cream into a coffee. Mm-hmm. And as you stir it, you know, that little funnel.
Vortex.
Goes down, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, that's space and time being twisted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if these lights will twist it into a loop. So it's a continuous loop. You can go forward or back on this loop. And so that's what he does. He's looping time, or he's getting time twisted into a loop that you can travel backwards to it. But again, only as far as the time machine was built.
Yeah, and this, it's intriguing. And by the way, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic and KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, and having this fascinating discussion here with author Marla Bell. And so again, thank you for coming in. And Marla, and I'm thinking about my example going back for Kat, and you know, and like you put a ripple in time. But one of the aspects of our nature is that we think in a linear manner. that, you know, this happened then, and there's a past, present, and future. And is that really the case in ultimate reality, or is it just something that we need to do in our human brains to make sense of what's happening around us? And quantum physics is starting to challenge that notion.
Oh, they are totally starting to challenge that notion. And again, it's changing every day. So it is, they're just going forward, leaps and bounds, and they're finding more and more and more stuff, which is fascinating. And it's fascinating to read. I mean, you could go down a rabbit hole just trying to discover all this new stuff that they're coming up with.
Right.
But, you know, and they also say, you know, if you think about it, past, present, and future, the present is almost the same as the past because it's so fleeting. I mean, it's right down, and now it's the past. Right now is now it's the past. I mean, you know, there's really, the present is just so fleeting.
We're,
you know,
30 minutes into our conversation. That's
and
past.
And it's already the past. Exactly. Yeah. You know, so it's really the past and the present are tied so closely together that it's, you know, it's easier to go back. But there's you know, all the paradoxes, you know, reading about all the paradoxes. And I have one in my book. And some people has had an issue with it yet, but I know some, but it's too new, and you know that I haven't gotten enough feedback yet, but I'm sure somebody's going to pick up on the paradox and say, no, wait a minute. You know, but one of my favorite time travel movies of all time is Somewhere in Time. Christopher Reeves and Jane, oh gosh, what's her name?
Yeah.
Whatever her name is. But anyway, I love that, but you know, and it was, and maybe it's what has always, maybe it put the idea of time, writing a time travel, because, she, you know, it starts out with him being a college student in college, or college professor maybe, and her, an old lady, coming to visit him in his first production of his play and giving him this watch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the watch then is the thing that sends him back in time. When he goes back in time, he gives the watch to her. So it's like, okay, now wait a minute. Where'd that watch come from? Did she have it? Did he have it? I mean, it was one of those things that there's no answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are always the fun things about time travel, is they always plant something like that, like a question in your mind. Well, how did that happen? And you're trying to make, there's no way to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a paradox of time travel. And there's got to be one in a time travel. So yeah, there's one in my story.
That's fascinating. And by the way, it's Jane Seymour.
Seymour, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's
I love instant Google. So I was able to find that. But, you know, see, this is intriguing because for a number of reasons. I am not one to read a lot of fantasy. Okay. But this is more sci-fi. And I can get into sci-fi in the sense that it, because it's not escape. It really does challenge preconceived notions about. So in order to write an authentic story, is it plausible, you know, for this to happen? So, you know, the rules aren't all gone, that there are some things happening, but it forces the reader to leave his, her comfort zone of security, that if I let go of this bottle here, it's going to go down rather than go up,
right,
or sideways,
right.
Okay, because we just simply take gravity for granted. So it challenges to get out of that, not only in terms of scientifically, but also in our own way we deal with life.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I mean, again, even in our own life, things are changing. I mean, just things, you know, if you think about it, how did we survive growing up when we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have all this stuff, that computers, you know, laptops, iPods, iPads, you know, all that stuff. How did we survive?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just got a brand new computer. It's got a backlit keyboard.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, how did I get by all these years without this? This is amazing. You know, I love it. You know, and things are changing in our lives every single day, you know. And I would you have even thought about that? 10 years ago even, maybe.
No.
You know, no, it's, you know, so new concept, you know, thank heavens that there's people out there that are smart and are just moving forward and bringing these new concepts and these new ideas and, you know, not afraid to stop.
But that presents a challenge, and we can go off into a whole thing here and sociologically and everything too, because technology has always been, you know, from the time that the ancients figured out that I can use this spear handle, and all instead of making a spear for every time I want to take down the big mastodon, I could, you know, just make a little arrow to the end of it, hurl the spear, and then pull the spear back and, you know, and reuse it. Okay, well, now we have the repeating rifle and stuff like this. Okay, that principle was there. So technology's been, ever since, you know, Homo sapiens evolved 70,000, 200,000 years ago. But what is demonstrably true is that it is accelerating at incredible speeds. That if you look at the advancements, let's say from 1900 to 2000, you'll see a nice rise blip from 2000 to 2018. It's even increasing faster because of it. But then are we comfortable with that? Our brains, are we adapting to it? The younger generations, they grew up with it. Okay, there you are. But you and I are not in the younger generation. How do we mesh with this ever accelerating technological advances going on? And I think you start to help address that in your work.
Well, it does. You know, the research and stuff, it's mind-boggling. You know, and it's hard for, well, again, I have 100% right brain. So it's some of the concepts are hard for me to grasp, but it's still fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see what these people are doing. Mm-hmm. And they are making great strides.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, that is intriguing there. So where do you get your ideas? Now, we had talked about, you know, back when your boys were young munchkins,
right.
You know, you said, okay, I'm getting into young adult here, and you wrote the fantasy. This latest work is more older young adult, mm-hmm. You know, and young adult in some way. Do you envision yourself writing a full-fledged adult novel? I mean, where does it come from, you know, your energy?
Well, you know, I used to not like talking about where I get, you know, I used to think that people would think I was crazy. But I write with a muse, or actually I call him a genius, because that's what the Romans called the spirit that helped artists and stuff. And he 100% gives me the ideas. They're his. And I named him Daniel just so I could have somebody, a name to argue with, because I argue with him. But the trilogy, the Destined story, was 100% his. And I, when I started it, like every good writer, I wrote out a little outline of what was going to happen. Well, that went out the window almost immediately. And it's very kind of stressful in a way, because I never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I, you know, when I sit down at the computer that day, I don't know where Daniel's going to take this story. And sometimes I would get up from the computer and then go back the next day and just read over what I wrote, and it would be like, holy crap, where did that come from?
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't even, it would just blow my mind. And he would put stuff in there that I didn't know the purpose, that there was a purpose. I just thought it would be a fluff thing. And, you know, in the next book or at the end of the book, it would come into play as something major, a major thing. And, you know, one in the second book, Once Upon a Darker Time, Destin got basically written into a corner. I had no idea where he was in the situation, that it was like, there's no way to get him out of this. And I stressed, I could see it coming, that he was getting into this position, and I didn't know what to do about it. And I stressed and stayed up nights trying to think of, how am I going to do this? And then one day, you know, basically when I got to that point where I needed to get him out, the answer was there, and it was this mm-hmm. little thing that had been put in at the beginning of the book. And I just sat back in awe, just like, wow, you know, I mean, it was so perfect, and it was so logical, and it's like, wow, you know, that, you know, my brain, I don't think, could have come up with that. But Daniel knew exactly what he was doing. And, you know, so it's an adventure. It's as much of an adventure for me to write this as it is for my readers to read it, because I'm learning and I'm seeing the story develop the same way as they are.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but I love it. But, you know, and I hated to talk about it because people, you know, kind of give me that look like, you know, you're insane. And I felt like there was something wrong with me writing that way, that I wasn't really the person who was, I don't feel like I'm really the person writing this. It's Daniel. And I'm just his outlet. But then I watched a TED Talk. From Elizabeth Gilbert,
okay,
who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. She did a TED Talk that a friend told me to watch it. And I watched that, and that changed my whole way of thinking. Because she talks about this exact thing, about how in the old, you know, in the ancient days, the Greek and the Romans did not believe that we had, a human, had the ability to be something, had a special talent. To have a special talent, that it was the spirit that, you know, came into you and had the talent and just lent it to you for, you know, a bit to get it out. And the Greeks called them daemons.
Yes.
The Romans called them geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And because the genius was like, you know, a spirit that just came out and did it. And so it kind of helped, it took the pressure off of, there was with magicians, with artists, painters, you know, sculptors, writers, you know, all kinds of art, not just a writer. But these spirits, these geniuses and demons, helped every aspect of the art, you know. And that helped keep, you know, the person from becoming, you know, getting their ego too high, you know, because it really wasn't them that was creating this spectacular masterpiece. It was their spirit, you know, their genius or whatever. Mm-hmm. And but we kind of got away from that, and now it's all on us. It's, you know, it's our failure or our success, you know, and that's really hard to take, you know. And I love going back to, I wish we would go back to that, because, you know, if it's hard to write a book, you know, and it takes a lot of time. And if it's not good, you know, the great thing about having a genius, if it's not good, it's not totally my fault. It's Daniel's fault, too. You know, he didn't show up that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what Elizabeth Gilbert was talking about this, you know, in this talk about how so many great artists, Tom Waits, mm-hmm, had a muse that would come and give him songs, and how he struggled with that. And I don't, there's a poet, too, she mentions it, I don't remember, but... It takes away some of that pressure. And but it also validated, you know, my way of writing. I felt like, well, maybe I'm not a freak as much as I thought, you know. So that helped me a little bit, and I don't mind talking about Daniel now, because he is huge. Although I do think the one thing issue I have with Daniel is that I think he must live in Australia, because he comes to me in the middle of the night, which is totally his day, my night, you know. And it's like, can you just come to me when I'm really actually sitting on my computer?
Well, it ends up happening in that. And thank you for that, Marla, because, you know, you're hitting it right on. For writers, especially creative writers in fiction, okay, where do these characters come from? I say right out, I sit down and talk to them, literally. I'll go up to my study and I'll pour myself a dram or two of scotch, and I'll sit there and I go, okay, Victorio, talk to me. You know, what's going on here? Because I want to get into his head. What is this? And I've done the same thing where you write him into a corner almost, and it's like, oh my God, how did I do this? Rather than fight it and say, okay, I'm just going to leave it there and I'll come back. And then the answer appears.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that when people look at you and say, well, you know, you're a little crazy or something like this, because of our modern left brain structured world in which everything is defined and put in boxes, you know, that it has, that people aren't comfortable with this.
Spirit coming and helping you, yeah.
Yeah, and I have a muse as well. And, you know, and her name is Denise. She's actually an old friend of mine that she died back 10 or more years ago. I taught with her, and she was brilliant. Oh, one of the most creative, brilliant minds I ever knew. And I go, okay, Denise, where are we on this here? And there's that energy that comes up.
It is.
At the, and you say in the middle of the night, yes, because we just cleared out all the crud from the day. Oh, I have to be on Jerry's show at this time, and oh, I'm in this traffic jam. Am I going to make it? Boom, all this is in your head. Okay, you get a nice, you know, even a few hours sleep, all that went away, and you wake up, and Daniel's going like, Marla, hello, time to start at it. So good for you. I think that's totally awesome.
Well, you know, like I said, it's fun. It is stressful at times, but it's fun, and I rely on him a lot. You know, even in my newest book, The Next Time I See You, I had a different vision of what Kat was going to do and what was going to happen, and I had a different vision than Daniel did, I should say, and he brought me around.
Right,
and,
on.
And it ended differently than what I expected it to.
That's the other thing too, is that because we talk, and are you more of a pantser? In other words,
totally, 100%, 100%.
Oh yeah, this planning stuff doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, you know, I try.
You try, as you said that, yeah.
And it's like it doesn't work, so there's no point in trying. But then on the other hand, you know, I've gone to a lot of conferences, you know, where and all these workshops. I mean, I've gone to hundreds. You know, and they'll, and some of them will have you, you know, say, okay, here's a prompt, you know, write, you know, something. And I sit there, and I can't do that. I'm not on the ball, on the spot, being able to just put out this great word, you know. It just doesn't come. I need Daniel, and I rely on him, which is kind of bad, but, you know, and like Elizabeth Gilbert says, though, you know, she said, if my work isn't good, I want it to be on the record right now that I showed up for my job. I showed up from 9 to 5, and my muse didn't.
So it's great to have someone to blame. You know, like, oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. I love it. Okay, I'll have to look for that on TED Talk then.
Seriously, I go back to it and listen to it every once in a while because it's very inspirational for me to make me feel like, you know, that... mm-hmm. That, you know, maybe, you know, it's hard. It's, you know, there's a lot of things come into your head, you know, like, you know, I'm a fraud, you know, can I really do this? Is this going to be, you know, good or whatever? You can't help but keep those things out of your
head. It's that same story that you were telling yourself when you were 16 years old.
Exactly. You know, that's true. And, you know, you just need that little bit, you know, my teacher. That's why I wish she was still here.
Yeah.
He could tell me, you know, Marla, that's not too bad. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that's why, you know, I hate to read reviews, but they are handy. They do just, you know, give you a boost once in a while that you need.
Mm-hmm.
To know that somebody else does like your work and maybe it's not as bad as you think it is.
Yeah, and I said that too when I put up my first book, writing on, is that if it affects and impacts someone in a positive way, at least one person, it was well worth it.
It was, yeah.
And I have heard from a good number and said, in ways that I never imagined when I wrote it. Because when we read something, we put it in our own context and we interpret. But then they still come back to you and say, thank you. And you go... okay, great. That's a great lesson for you, me, and other writers like us, is to just trust the muse. Just trust it.
Don't
worry about out there. It'll take care of itself.
Absolutely. Right. And not everyone's going to like every piece of work. I mean, we all are different tastes.
Sure.
And that's what makes this world as great as it is.
Yeah.
Because it would be boring if everybody liked the same thing.
Oh, tell me. Yeah. You know, it's all called, you know, like one shade of pale.
Exactly. And that's why it's so great that there's so many great writers here in Colorado alone.
Oh, yeah.
And they say, oh, there's getting to be too many with this new indie publishing thing. It's getting inundated. There's too many. And it's like, well, no, I don't think that there can be too many. Because everybody has different ways and different stories and, you know...
Yeah,
there's going to be somebody out there. You're going to find somebody out there that you're going to like.
Yeah, and you're going to be up at the Book Nook at the Georgetown Christmas Market.
I'm coming to the Christmas Market. I'm excited about that. So I hope we see a lot of people.
Okay, then we'll get the word out on that more. But right now I got 30 different authors, not all on the same day, but my Saturdays are pretty much booked and Sundays are getting real close there.
Nice.
So when people walk in there, they're going to see a panoply of genres, fiction, nonfiction, fantasy, young adult, children, adult, whatever. And it's like, yeah, you need to get up because these are great stocking stuffers.
Great Christmas presents. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's get the world back to reading. Get them off of those games and those, especially kids.
Yeah.
Get them off of those games and stuff. That's just warping their mind.
Well, and if someone wants to get your work before the Christmas market, how might they do it?
Well, it's on Amazon, Amazon print and ebook. It's on BarnesandNoble.com for the print. In some of the libraries it's on. And also, I write under the name of MJ Bell.
Okay.
So it's just MJ Bell. So.
And what's your website? Because it's not as real.
My website is MJ-Bell.com.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
MJ-Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
.com. Yeah. So.
Yeah. My nephew is MJ Bell too. His name is Matthew James, and he is he's a reporter for the NPR.
Oh wow.
BBC NPR. So he grabbed all of the MJ Bell things before I got to them, and that's why I had to put the hyphen in there. But yeah, if you come across some MJ Bell, that's a male. That's my nephew Matthew.
Yeah, but it's all family.
It's all family, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful! It must be fascinating conversations you have with him.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, right on. So, well, Marla, thank you so much. This has been absolutely intriguing.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. All right, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic and KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole and visiting here with Marla Bell. And we're going to go ahead and take a break. And I will be back in a little while. So how about if we just play a little bit of music, okay? And hang on. That was wonderful.
It was great. Thanks.